Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you could join me as we go diving into the collections of classic cardboard. And we've got some classic cardboard to talk about this week. In fact, a lot of the times it wasn't cardboard. It was something that was more, adhesive. A sticker, shall we say? It's actually a card nowadays. There are some sticker versions, but we're talking about the classic wacky packages, garbage pail kids, and the ill-fated trash can trolls. Yes, some very interesting non-sports entries into the Wax Ecstatic history. This is our first non-sports show. I would prefer it be our only non-sports show, simply because, and I've said this before, and it bears repeating, it is a very, very deep, dark rabbit hole, the non-sports card world, because you not only get into different generations of these particular brands, but you've got movie cards, you've got comic book cards, you've got all sorts of, it's just a whole new world. It's a completely different universe. One that I never really got in outside of Garbage Pail Kids. And I know some people want, hey, let's do something about Star Wars. Let's do, the cards from the 70s compared to today. And I just really don't want to touch that because, again, there's just so much out there. You can really get lost in the rabbit hole. But I had to bring up these particular brands. First, because as you know, if you listen to this podcast on a regular basis, several shows back, I bought one of those, mystery variety packs of packs from eBay. And you see these everywhere where people, they have a huge collection of wax and cello packs and rack packs, and you pay something like $20 and they'll throw in, 8 or 10 of these packs, and you hope that you get a hit with one of the older packs, and you know that most of it is junk wax era stuff. And this particular person that I bought it from sent me a rather average collection of packs, to be honest. But some of the non-sports packs, and I thought it'd be fun, some of the non-sports packs that they sent were Topps Desert Storm and Desert Shield cards, and I remember those from 1990 and 91. There was the 1991 Pop Music cards, which I haven't opened yet. That may be something I just do for the hell of it and just share one day. And Garbage Pail Kids. There was a pack of the 8th series of Garbage Pail Kids, and it brought back some memories of how controversial those things were. And by popular demand, by listener demand, there were enough people that said, yeah, go ahead and talk about it. We're doing this podcast. So we're going to look not only at the Garbage Pail Kids and the Trash Can Trolls, but really where it all starts, and that is wacky packages. And there's a history behind the wacky packages. In fact, prior to wacky packages starting, this is actually kind of getting at the beginning of some of the brands of sports cards that we love now. Sports cards really didn't take off until, or especially baseball cards, but the baseball card as we know it really didn't take off until after World War II. But if you look through the history of sports cards, even though we go back to the late 1800s for baseball cards, a lot of the cardboard collectibles that were printed between the 1880s and the 1940s were non-sports. So there's a long history to it, and we'll get to that in today's show. Also, we're going to get to, with our question and answer request that we threw out on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains, we've got some follow-ups to our previous podcast. I know a lot of you really enjoyed the multiplayer rookie card, the Andrew Ridgely episode, as we like to call it. If you don't know who Andrew Ridgely is, he is jokingly known as the other guy from Wham, the 1980s pop group. Of course, George Michael, far more recognizable with Wham. And again, don't feel bad for Andrew Ridgely. He's making lots of money off of the music rights that he wrote a couple of those hit songs for Wham and for George Michael as a solo artist. So it was a lot of fun to go through some of the more notable multiplayer rookie cards throughout the 1960s and 70s, but also to tell the stories of some of the other guys, the Andrew Ridgelys, on those cards. Some very interesting stories there. There were a few that I left off, a couple on purpose, others I just overlooked. And because we're talking about Garbage Pail Kids in this show, and you don't really have backstories to the Garbage Pail Kids, at least nothing nonfiction. I'm sure we could make something up. But we'll touch up in just a few minutes on some of the other players that, again, it was either on purpose or by accident, I didn't get around to bringing up in the last show. And, you know, not only talking about some of the star players that show up on those cards, but a couple of interesting other guys as well. And I won't give you the full biographies of some of these players, but a little background information on some of those other guys that are linked to more popular players on their multi-panel rookie cards. So we will get to that in just a moment as well. Also, I want to give you a heads up on next show. I don't want to say next week's show because we do the show every other Friday. But on our next show, which is February 28th at noon Eastern, we will be opening up a pack of 1974 Tops. I don't know if it's an 8-count or a 10-count pack. We will get into the details of some of the confusion with the 1974 Tops packs, because that was the first year that they did the entire set in one series, one 660-card series. And they used wrappers, different wrappers, one that was basically a complete ripoff of what they designed in 1966. And then they did different variations of wrappers, which represent different numbers of cards that are in the packs. It causes some confusion in 1976 because Topps, trying to save money, reused some of those 1974 wrappers. So, you know, we'll dive deep into that. But the reason why I want to tell you about the 74 Topps show, which will, again, be coming up in 2 weeks, not only because we want to get you excited about some vintage wax and some good stories behind the set itself, but also it's a nice thank you. I won't mention this person by name, but it is a nice thank you to a generous donation through our PayPal account, and that is paypal.me/waxecstatic. We had a very generous donation that helped cover the cost of buying a pack of 74 Tops, and it's not extremely cheap. It's it cost me about $55 to get it, which is a bargain compared to some of the other prices that I've seen for it. But I just want to let you know that we not only have that fun pack to open up in our video link and that fun pack to discuss and dive into the history of 74 Tops again. We've talked about it before, but we will definitely get around to it in greater detail in a couple weeks. But again, it goes to show that your donations to paypal.me/waxecstatic help this show out in numerous ways. One is purchasing products. So if we get enough donations, we can pool the money together, not only get some of those fun bargain bin beauties, or, you know, diving through the, you know, $3 for $5 boxes at the local card show, but being able to go out and confidently bid $40, $50, $60, $70 on a vintage pack of cards and come take it home with us. So we're looking forward to that. Also, some recent contributions have helped purchase a couple of vintage packs that we're going to be opening up a little later on in the run of the show. And will also help us buy some of the Topps Heritage packs that are coming out soon, which of course mirrors the 1971 set. So again, thank you to all those who have given a donation. We take donations of any denomination. It could just be as little as $5. It can be more. But it not only goes to the purchase of the products that we discuss on this program, it also goes to the maintenance of the show. So we pay Audio Boom an annual fee to host the show and to share it on the RSS feed to all the other platforms that you may listen to it on. And it also helps us keep our archives free. And the archives are really coming in handy right now, because I've had a lot of people ask me about the new book that's coming up from Brad Blukjan called The Wax Pack Project. And quite a few people going, hey, wouldn't you like to talk about this or talk to the author? And I say, yes, we did. Back in the summer of 2016, Brad was a guest of ours when we were talking about 86 Tops and when the just initial idea of the Wax Pack book was coming together. So for free, you can go back in our archives, listen to episode 20. And this is when the book was still coming together and they were planning on a publication date. And I know originally they were looking at, late 2018, early 2019 for the book to come out. Well, here it is. It's coming out in just a few weeks here. And like I said, in the previous episode, I will be reaching out to Brad soon when the book comes out to talk about the process of getting the book across the finish line and maybe just a brief recap of, what took him from an idea to writing the book to finding the players that he found in a pack of 1986 Tops. And it's going to be a really interesting where are they now kind of book. And as I mentioned in the last episode too, I hope it sparks others to do the same. Much like in that book that I discussed, Dodger Dogs to Fenway Franks, visiting major league ballparks, all major league ballparks in one big road trip. That was something that was done in the mid-80s. Now people do it all the time. Having athletes open up packs of baseball cards and talk about the players that they played with or against. And it's not just baseball. It's football. It's hockey. That's something that a lot of people do nowadays. So I hope that Brad's book will inspire others to do the same thing as well. In a legal sense, again, don't open up a pack of baseball cards and try to track down Daryl Strawberry. don't go on Carlton Fisk's property, as Brad will tell you. You will get a not-so-pleasant shunning, shall we say. This all goes back to your donations, helping keep the archives free and available for anyone to listen to at any time. I could very easily just put a gate down after, say, episode 120 and prior. You have to pay a certain monthly fee or a per-episode fee. Rather not do that. Would like to keep that free for everybody. So, again, if you have a few extra bucks in your pocket and you would like to make that donation, do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. As I mentioned, we're on the air every other Friday, noon Eastern, via Audioboom and all the other platforms. Make sure you tell your friends about the program. Rate and review the program as well if you're listening to it on a platform such as Apple Podcasts that allows you to do it. If you give us a positive review, it just moves us up a little bit in the algorithm that tells people who are listening to similar shows that they should listen to us as well. And we certainly appreciate that organic promotion. There's an industry buzzword right there. It's organic promotion. It doesn't cost you a thing. We appreciate all of that through your kind words and good ratings that you pass along as well. And don't forget, too, to talk about the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline, as the feed is open 24/7. And we enjoy just talking about the hobby in general, but also if you have any questions or comments or suggestions, we gladly accept those. The DMs are normally open, too. If I'm not following you, just ask for a follow. I'll follow back. It's hard to follow everybody, so if you want to DM me, you can do that as well and ask questions there. Talk about the show, the product we talk about, the players we talk about, and again, suggestions too. I'm always open for show suggestions, and we will do our best to try to meet some suggestions. I can't promise that we hit them all. This is not all request radio, and that's a good thing. And, if there's something that strikes our fancy, then we'll go ahead and do it. Now, I want to get to a note that was actually sent to me through DM, through Mr. DM, Doug McCready. And I say Mr. DM, that's just a play on your initials of your first and last name there. I feel so bad about this because Doug sent this note to me actually about a month ago. And I said, okay, I'll talk about it on the next show. And then for two consecutive shows, I just totally forgot to talk about it. So Doug, better late than never, but here I am. He sent me a question that says, curious, and I'm sure you've answered this a lot and or it's obvious, but did Topps all but eliminate the off-centered card when they switched cardstock in the early 90s? I look at the old ones of mine and so many are off-centered. Well, Doug, I don't believe it has anything to do with the card stock per se, which of course they changed up in 1992 going to the all-white card stock. But I think it has something more to do with just technology, also product oversight, and also competition as well. When you look back at a lot of your cards from the 60s and 70s and even into the early 80s, you're going to have quite a few off-centered cards here. And a lot of it was, again, you know, the technology, I don't want to say it was primitive, but you're using printing presses and cutting devices that were probably in use in the Topps factory since the 1940s or 1950s at least. Once Cy Berger created the baseball card as we know it, and once the baseball card set its standard sizes in 1957, they were probably using machines that were, you know, adjusted to make those particular cuts back in 1957. So for the next 20, 25 years, you had a lot of these same cutting and centering issues throughout the set. But not only was it technology, but also, again, there was no competition starting in 1956 once Topps bought out Bowman and was able to successfully fend off Fleer and other competitors throughout the 1960s. You're probably just dealing with some old equipment there. So as computerized equipment comes into vogue in the early 80s, you can become a little more precise with how things are lined up when they're designed, how they're laid out, how they're cut as they go through the whole process. So you have less and less likelihood of off-centered cards. But also, and I've noticed, you know, the off-centering really started to get addressed, I'd say around 82 or 83. I don't think it's an accident that this happens when Fleer and Donruss comes around. There's not only competition, but now the collecting hobby has become more of a business. So you can't be putting out a substandard product, first of all, because you're going to be losing market share on it. And second, you don't want these upstarts from Fleer and Donruss eventually taking it over, because once they figured out how to do everything, you don't want them to have a better product, something that is consistently centered properly, as opposed to yours that are coming out, you know, 80-20 all the time. So I think there was, with the increased competition as well as the technological changes, you had a little more product oversight, people double-checking that everything was coming through okay, and fewer of these off-centered cards got out into the market. I do recall going through some 1981 Topps cards recently, seeing several that were off-centered, so it was still something that was creeping into the product in the early 80s. But I think for the most part, not always, but for the most part, once you got to the mid-80s, Topps had refined the process enough to where even if a card did come out off-centered, it was not grossly off-centered. Like some of the cards from the 70s in particular, where you see, you know, the little stars from the border of the sheet that were so grossly miscut. You know, these, you know, Hall of Fame cards that you're pulling out of your packs and you're going, ah, I got a Reggie Jackson card, but it's at, you know, 90-10. Gee, thanks, guys. Those days were long gone. For those number of reasons. And I think one other reason why Topps didn't address this earlier, and it goes back to what we were talking about with Topps saving money in the 1970s. They were just too cheap. So if you don't have the competition, nobody can really complain because there's no alternative that people can go to. And this was still a hobby. You know, people were still wrapping rubber bands and paper clipping their cards and, you know, clipping to their bicycle spokes. Well, who cares? You know, no harm, no foul, right? So because they were cheap and Topps didn't really want to reinvest any money into the equipment or the oversight to make sure that it looked right every time it came off the factory line, then, you know, it just wasn't going to get fixed. So I think everything kind of came together about 10 years before you mention it. You know, the card stock change in 1992. Yeah, it was important. You didn't want off-center cards then because by then it's a $1 billion industry. And you don't want to upset collectors by putting out a dud product that's never centered. But I really think that the changes started happening around 81, 82, and they certainly refined it by the mid-80s. Nothing was perfect at that time, but it was certainly a far cry. You look at a 85 or an 86 Topps card when it comes to centering, it's much better than, say, a 75 or 76 card. Now, the good side about some off-center cards is if you're not too tremendously upset. You know, this falls into the stray category, as I like to call it. Those cards that feature Hall of Fame players, or they're big rookie cards, but they're slightly off-centered, or they're dinged up, or there's a little crease or whatever. You can get your hands on these cards for extremely, cheap amounts. And recently at a card show, I picked up, it was a 1960 Orlando Cepeda that was off-centered. The front was off-centered. It's probably an 80-20, but everything else is pretty crisp about it. And I paid $2 for it. So, you know, you look at that and you're like, that's not so bad. And, you know, I picked up several other cards like that. Again, just slightly off-center. But, you know, when you're looking at, you know, spending, you know, a couple $100 for a PSA 8 or 9, as opposed to $2 just to say I've got myself a 60 Orlando Cepeda, then, hey, you know, I'll go ahead and take the latter of the two. So, Doug, it took a while to answer the question there. I apologize again, but I'm glad that you hung with us. And it was a great question, too. A lot of different factors into why the miscentering of Topps cards has changed and improved over the years. Now, as for the multiplayer rookie cards, as I mentioned in that show, I didn't want to go through each and every notable multiplayer rookie card because you could do that show for hours. You really could. And I want to try to keep this in a nice-sized performance here. So I wasn't able to go through all of them. I purposely, in the last show, switched over, instead of listing each and every notable card from the 60s and 70s, once I got to 1972, we focused on the handful of cards that we were looking at, mostly because I had the Carlton Fisk card, and we were starting with that look at the other guys on the cards. But I do want to touch up on a few others, and fans brought this up in the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline. First of all, Scott Smith, a great story here. A friend of mine started talking with a guy on a train in France years ago. He turned out to be John Hilton, the Padres prospect who joined Ron Say on the vaunted 1973 Mike Schmidt rookie card. Now, that is a great rookie card to talk about because, you know, Ron Say had a pretty decent career as well. He was no Mike Schmidt, but Ron Say's rookie card was on the coattails of a legendary Hall of Famer who played for Philadelphia, of course. And, Schmitty and Say, it kind of goes much like Ryan and Kuzman. You know, Kuzman was no Nolan Ryan, but he was pretty darn good at what he did. So that's a great card. I thank you for bringing that up, Scott. Just a quick story about John Hilton, who was also known as Dave Hilton. In fact, Dave was his middle name. So when you look at the 73 Topps card, John Hilton, that's his birth name. But if you look at his 74 Topps card, it is Dave Hilton. And he had a very brief career in the big leagues, but a very talented third baseman from Texas, moved on up through the Padres organization. And because the Padres were so terrible, it was not an easy transition for him into the big leagues. However, he hits his first major league home run off of one Ferguson Jenkins. That ain't so bad. However, that was one of the few offensive highlights that he had. He really struggled offensively, was a decent defender. But of course, when you're playing third base, many people, if you're looking at the old school way of pulling together a baseball team, you're looking at power on the corners. He didn't have a lot of power, struggled to hit the ball well in the major leagues, spent a lot of time in the minor leagues. And by 1975, the Padres were looking to, kind of make or break Dave Hilton at third base. Well, he contracted hepatitis at the beginning of the season. He had some serious food poisoning from a bad seafood dinner. And he was out for the next 2 weeks, very slowly but surely worked his way back into the lineup, but really struggled to get back to 100%. I mean, if you've ever had a GI infection, you know it takes weeks, if not months, to really clear that up. It is not a fun thing. Well, by the time 1976 comes around, the Padres have acquired Doug Rader from Houston. So poor Dave Hilton's kind of left hanging there. And basically, he's just playing in the minor leagues. Now, he's playing in Hawaii, the Islanders were the Padres' AAA affiliate at the time. So not all that bad living in Honolulu, but of course he wants to be in the majors. Dave Hilton gets an opportunity with the Blue Jays. As Peter Bavese, who is with the Blue Jays at the time, he basically likes Hilton. Of course, he drafted Hilton in San Diego, and he signs him along with several other players in October of 1976. So Hilton was told that he was going to be the starting third baseman for the Blue Jays in April of 1977, but Hilton did not sign a contract, and here's why. And this is some great detail from Chuck Johnson for the Society for American Baseball Research. Love this story here. The Blue Jays in 1977, because they had so many veteran players and nobody was really sure where everybody fit in, there was basically a split contract where if you made the major league team, obviously you were going to be a major league player and receive major league benefits. But if you didn't make it, then you essentially were signing a minor league contract. In the NHL, this is what we call two-way contracts, where you can sign a two-way contract, and if you play in the NHL, you make this much money. If you play in the AHL, you make this much money in the minor leagues. Well, Hilton felt that he was better than this. He was told he was going to be the starting third baseman for the Blue Jays, and you know, he had a good resource, the guy that drafted him in San Diego. And when you're the first overall selection, you think even on an expansion team, all right, you've almost got the right to be a major league player, to have a major league contract, get major league money and benefits. But that didn't happen, as the Blue Jays decided to send him down to AAA, which at that time was in Toledo. This is before they started their long run with Syracuse as their AAA club. So Hilton now is a minor leaguer. He didn't want to sign this split contract here. So the Jays send him down. He fights through AAA. He eventually goes on to Japan and plays in Japan for several seasons, becomes a very popular player there. He would then come back stateside, bouncing around the minor leagues, the Mexican League as well, and eventually became a minor league manager and coach. He was also the founder and operator of the Arizona School of Baseball in Scottsdale. He was a very big proponent and coach in Little League Baseball, sadly passing away in September of 2017 at the age of 67. But from what I can see through stories of Dave Hilton, just legendary in the Little League scene in Arizona. So sad story there, but again, a great example of the other guy. You know, Dave Hilton had a very brief career with the Padres, had a lot of just bad luck along the way. You know, the food poisoning, the hepatitis, the Padres, you know, going in a different direction at third base, being told one thing and delivered another in Toronto. It wasn't an easy path for him, but once he came back stateside, he was a very, very positive impact on youth baseball for about 35 years in Arizona. Now, another great card, of course, we've talked about this card a little bit and why it was a big reason for Topps ditching the multiplayer rookie format in 1983. And that is, of course, the 1982 Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card, in which Topps basically, quote unquote, re-released a standalone rookie card in the 82 traded set for Ripken. Now, the two other guys that are on that card are Bob Bonner and Jeff Schneider. Well, let me start with Jeff Schneider, who I found a little Q&A about him online. Jeff Schneider basically didn't play in the major leagues after the 1981 season. He had a little cup of coffee in the 81 season. By 1982, he's moving to the Angels. He's part of the Doug DeCinces trade, and he doesn't stick in the Angels system. He goes to the Blue Jays system for a little bit, and that's about it. He basically quit baseball afterwards and went to school, got a job, and in his words, basically lived a normal life. So good for him. Bob Bonner, on the other hand, it's funny because Bonner is listed on that card as a shortstop. And of course, Ripken, for much of his career, would play at short. But Bonner is just smiling away on the rookie card here. And I remember commenting on the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline going, boy, if Bob Bonner only knew what was going on here. Well, we dug around and we found out Bonner basically went down a similar path as Schneider. You know, played, saw very little playing time in the major leagues, was out of the major leagues by the mid-80s. But here's the positive story of the other guy. Bob Bonner would go on to become a charity leader in Africa, and he still serves. He's basically a missionary in Africa, and he's been doing so for about 35 years now. So once again, may not be a major league star, wouldn't even call him a common player. He's just the other guy on the rookie card, a very famous rookie card, and doing great things around the world. So good for Bob Bonner. A couple others here. I don't want to get into biographies, but I just want to mention some names. William Wagner says you should include Brian Banks from the 95 Topps set with Vlad Guerrero and Andrew Jones. Also, the 92 Topps prospect card with Pat Mahomes would be appropriate for this weekend. Now, this weekend was leading into the Super Bowl, and congratulations to Patrick Mahomes on picking up, I should say, a surprise Super Bowl victory, but given how the Chiefs were trailing at the second half every stinking game that they played in the playoffs and still managed to win, I guess we all saw it coming, right? Well, let's actually talk about that Pat Mahomes rookie card. It is card number 676 from the 1992 set, and he's featured alongside Sam Militello, Turk Wendell, and Roger Salkeld. Now, Salkeld, I remember, was a highly touted prospect, a pitcher for the Mariners, and nothing ever came of his big league career. And again, I don't want to get too deep into the biographies here because we do have some Garbage Pail Kids and Wacky Packages to talk about. But I just remember Salkeld was one of those guys that you expected some really great things, but nothing ever really materialized from that. Same thing with Sam Militello. Militello was a highly prospected prospect for the Yankees. I knew him or knew of him well growing up in the Tampa area because he and his family were very influential in the Tampa area. And then Turk Wendell, most of you actually know as the oddball pitcher who did some very strange things, including having his contract, his annual pay, rounded out to 99999, you know, 99 cents, basically, because, you know, he wore the uniform number 99 in some of his stops. But he also did more bizarre things like, you know, after every pitch, he would walk around the mound, you know, after every pitch, he would say something at the pitching rubber before every or in between innings, he would brush his teeth. Very Mark Fidrick like, but slightly more psychotic, I think is the best way to put it. As you know, Turk Wendell certainly made a name for himself more as a little bit of a sideshow than more of a pitcher. He wasn't a terrible pitcher, but he was better known for his antics than his actual ability to play. Now, we know that Pat Mahomes Sr., if you will, you know, had a pretty decent career, and we've all seen the pictures of young Patrick Mahomes with his dad about, what, 15, 20 years ago, as the case may be. I'm curious, and I can probably do a little more research on this, but I'm curious if there's going to be a slight bump in the Pat Mahomes rookie card. I doubt it, just because, you know, Pat Mahomes Sr., again, didn't have a very lengthy or notable career. It was a good career, but certainly wasn't Hall of Fame worthy. But I think if you're looking at father-son sports cards, you know, you look at somebody like, oh, I don't know, Buddy Bell and Gus Bell, or Ken Griffey Jr. and Ken Griffey Sr. Sometimes the child is known more or better known than the father in this case. And that happens a lot in baseball. You have baseball families, you know, the Boone family. You can sit there and argue, all right, you know, this generation of Boones or Griffeys or Bells or whatever was better than this other generation. But I'm curious if this is one of the few times where you have a football star with sports cards out there that are going to get more money than the baseball cards of his father. And it could work the other way. You know, there may be a baseball star whose son was in football or whose father was in football, I should say. And, you know, maybe the baseball card is more valuable than the football card. Like I said, I could probably do a little more research on this, but I just, as I'm looking at this card, I'm thinking, oh, this is an interesting conundrum here with the Pat Mahomes rookie card. I doubt, though, since it's a 1992 card, again, because he didn't have, let's say, an illustrious major league career, you're going to see much of a bump. However, I wouldn't be surprised if there are more people buying the Pat Mahomes Sr. rookie card or any Pat Mahomes baseball card to pair up with the Patrick Mahomes football cards that you may have picked up over the last couple of years. Now, as for the other card that William brings up, the 95 Top Prospects, this card number 435, this is another one that is right up there with the Schmidt and Say and Hilton card, where you have Vlad Guerrero, recent Hall of Fame induction. You have Andrew Jones, who had a very, very good career. But then the other guys, William brings it up, Brian Banks with the Milwaukee Brewers, but also Billy McMillan of the Florida Marlins. So again, you've got some yin and yang going on with these particular rookie cards. So William, thank you so much for that suggestion. One last one from Mets in 2020! Exclamation point. I don't know what the Mets will be doing in 2020, but Steve Cohen probably won't have his fingerprints on it. He mentions, don't forget Bill Dennehy swapped for Gil Hodges. And of course, Bill Dennehy was on the Tom Seaver rookie card in 1967. And yes, this was one of those rare occurrences where a manager was acquired for a player. Bill Dennehy was traded to the Washington Senators in 1968 so that Gil Hodges could become the manager of the Mets after Wes Westrum stepped aside in the 1967 season. A great point there. And in fact, I had almost forgotten in the recesses of my memory that Bill Dennehy was traded for manager Gil Hodges. It's not that often that you see deals like that. The only other one I can think of, and it's prominent because it happened here in the Tampa Bay area, was back in 2002 when Lou Piniella still had a year left on his contract with the Seattle Mariners as their manager, and his mother was very ill and he wanted to come back home to Tampa. And you know, basically the Devil Rays at the time had to work out a deal with the Mariners where Randy Wynn, who would be an all-star with the Mariners, was traded for the rights, you know, basically to break Lou Piniella's contract and then sign him as a manager. And Lou was the right guy at the wrong time in Tampa Bay, very much like Sam Weish with the Buccaneers. Very good coach, certainly a fun personality. Depending on which side of the fence Lou thought about you. But yeah, it was more unfortunate timing for Lou. He had no chance of doing anything here. But unlike Lou, you know, Gil Hodges was able to, in a very short amount of time, take that raw group of New York Mets and turn them into world champions in 1969. Of course, tragically passing away just a few years later from a heart attack. So a lot of great comments, some follow-ups from our multiplayer rookie card show. Thank you again to everybody who contributed at Wax and Gum Stains. All right, let's dive into the main topic of our program this week, and that is the rare non-sports card venture of Wax Ecstatic, as we're going to take a look at Garbage Pail Kids, Trash Can Trolls, and Wacky Packages. And I cannot thank enough Mr. Brian Kilby, who sent me a wonderful donation of cards, not only the packs that we opened up, but some excess packs. And what I'm going to do is I will tell you how we're going to do this at the end of the program. But I have an extra pack of 4th Series Garbage Pail Kids, 8th Series Garbage Pail Kids, and then the Trash Can Trolls. And what we will do is we'll basically just auction these off here. And highest bidder will win them. I'll ship them out to you. And the bid will basically just go into the PayPal account here. You'll, you know, pay for it, and we'll go ahead and take that money and utilize it into purchasing more products for the show. But Brian, I want to thank you because he reached out several weeks ago and said, "Oh, would you like for me to, you know, give you some cards?" And I said, "Sure, but you know, nothing major, just a couple packs." And we got 6 packs of cards here, plus a stack of some newer cards too. So really, thank you so much, Brian, for the donation. Really, really appreciate it. Now, those were the Garbage Pail Kids and Trash Can Trolls. I found the Wacky Packages a pack online on eBay, and you can still get some of what we will call the repackaged Wacky Packages from the late 70s. You can still find them relatively cheap. I think I paid $8 for my pack, plus shipping, which is only $3 or $4. But you can still get them if you're interested in looking at the original Wacky Packages. You can find some that are affordable. Some of the original runs, though, may cost you a little more, but we'll get into that in just a bit. Now, as I said, even though Wacky Packages started in the late 1960s, as you'll find out, its origin goes way back and is part of the big story of sports cards in general. And like I said, a lot of people think that sports cards or baseball cards in particular started with the tobacco cards of the late 1880s, or the late 1800s, I should say. And that's partially true, but let's also remember too that sports athletes, especially baseball players, were not held in a very high regard back at the turn of the century. And it wouldn't be until the 1920s with Babe Ruth and the New York Yankees and the, you know, the pinstripe honor that kind of took America by storm. It really wasn't until the 20s and the end of the dead ball era that baseball became beloved by practically everyone. And the baseball player went from this ragamuffin who isn't good enough to go get a college degree and a real job, or, you know, a ragamuffin who isn't good enough to, you know, study a trade and, you know, do something with his life, like be a baker or, you know, a plumber or a bus driver. You know, this guy, all he does is barnstorm and he plays this game and he carouses with women and is out drinking. That was kind of the mindset for many, many, many years. So when sports cards came out in the late 1800s featuring baseball players, they really were representative of the company that made them, which were often tobacco companies. They wanted to get, you know, give a little incentive for people who were buying chewing tobacco or smoking tobacco. And of course, it also lured children into it, which is the backstory of Honus Wagner, of course, not wanting to be part of that T206 set. And that's why they pulled that, because he didn't want to be associated with chewing tobacco, allegedly. So outside of the sports cards that were coming around, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, people who made cards had to focus on other things. So they would focus on great moments in history, of great people in American history or world history. Or if you look hard enough, you can find from the 1920s and 30s and 40s, non-sports cards about motor cars, about war. There was actually a set of cards detailing great moments in war. There's circus animals. I mean, there's all sorts of just odd things, and that's mostly because these cards, you would insert them into boxes of candy or chewing gum, stuff like that. And the modern baseball card, of course, we all go back to 1952 Topps and what Cy Berger created, but also, you know, the idea of creating a sports card featuring ball players, you know, now they were seen more in a, I don't want to say a heroic light, but they were certainly seen in a much better light than what they were in the early 1900s. Didn't really happen until post-World War II. And that, of course, is, you know, Bowman takes off in the late 1940s, Topps comes in, and the rest, as they say, is history. So even though I don't personally like to dive too much into non-sports cards, the paths of sports and non-sports collectibles, they cross paths numerous times, and they do so going back even 150 or so years. So that's just kind of the grand picture of non-sports cards. There is a link to sports cards. And just like collecting sports cards, there's no wrong way to collect sports cards. Even though I'm not big on non-sports cards, if that's something you want to collect, by all means, do it. Whatever makes you happy. And, you know, hopefully you find just as much joy collecting cards, if it's Star Wars or Garbage Pail Kids, or even just bizarro cards from the 1980s. At one card show I went to, a guy had some non-sports cards. I mean, there's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. There's Growing Pains, you know, that 1980s TV sitcom. It's just all sorts of cards were just produced en masse in the 70s and 80s. And one big reason for that is because of Wacky Packages, which comes around in 1967. Now, the story behind Wacky Packages is there were several artists who worked at Topps who wanted to lampoon popular items. And some of the names will sound familiar to collectors, especially Art Spiegelman, who has a very big effect on the creation of Garbage Pail Kids, but also Kim Deitch, Bill Griffith, Jay Lynch, Norm Saunders. There's about 10 other artists and creators at Topps. They just want to create a set of non-sports stuff. And at first they decide, well, rather than just do like, you know, Andy Warhol pop culture, where we're just making a card of, you know, a can of Coke or whatever, they said, well, what if we spoof it a little bit? Of course, comedy has been around forever. Humor's been around forever. Satire's been around forever. Satire goes back millennia to the days of the Roman and the Greek drama days. So, you know, this is something that is not new, but it is seen as highbrow humor in the 1950s and 60s, and especially in the 60s, as you've got a baby boom generation that is becoming more and more suspicious of what the norm is. So you've got this kind of bubbling under here, and you've got this generation that is always kind of looking sarcastically at just everything and questioning everything. So that is, you know, what's behind things such as Mad Magazine and the national popularity of National Lampoon's magazine. And you've got satire artists such as Stan Freberg with Hit Records and Bob Newhart. And there's a whole new style of stand-up comedy because it's easy to not just crack a joke, you know, the old-fashioned Henny Youngman, take my wife, please, but to actually have something that's a little more cutting and a little more in-depth. And you see that as the 1960s roll out with the Smothers Brothers and Rowan and Martin. And, you know, there's a different type of humor. So, you know, in 1967, when the idea of Wacky Packages is gelling together here with these artists from Topps, it's really an incredible sign of society at that time, where you didn't just look at a can of Coca-Cola and go, oh, there's a can of Coca-Cola. You can look at it and go, that's a can, we're going to call it Coca-Bola, and we're going to shape it like a toilet bowl, you know, and I'm just totally making this up off the top of my head. But you get the point, where you can just take something that's popular, twist the name around a little bit, have some fun with it, and create some interesting art out of it. So when Wacky Packages first started in 1967, they weren't the stickers that we're aware of. They were actually die-cut cards. You were supposed to punch them out, and you could adhere them to any other surface here. But it was kind of a rough product that came out, and it featured, you know, certain names. For example, Moron Salt. So that's a playoff of Morton Salt. Well, the people who ran Morton Salt didn't really like that. So you start getting the cease and desist letters. And it's not just Morton Salt. It's also Jolly Green Giant vegetables. It's Ritz Crackers. It's Animal Crackers. So all of these companies are seeing their names lampooned, and they're going, no, we're not going to have any of that. So eventually, Topps would have to pull some of these items here or replace them. But the artists at Topps know, hey, we've got a little bit of a hit here. You know, if it's ruffling the feathers of the establishment, then, you know, let's keep putting it out here. So in 1969, they did a very similar follow-up called Wacky Ads. So again, you've got advertisements of these familiar products that are being mocked. So again, the cease and desist are coming out. So Maxwell House Coffee, there was an ad for Mixwell Hearse Coffee. Maxwell House obviously didn't like it. Good and Plenty, the little candies. You may know the sister candy called Mike and Ike's. Good and Plenty's are similar to Mike and Ike's. Well, the wacky ad was Good and Empty. Well, Leaf Brand, ironically the parent company of Donruss many, many years later, they, you know, go ahead and start threatening to sue Topps then. So they have to pull that. So it's kind of this little interesting dance here of these items that are created, put out in the market, and then they've got to be switched around because, you know, the company that's being mocked doesn't really like it. So that was the very beginning of the Wacky Pack idea. Was first the Wacky Pack punch outs that you could adhere somewhere, and then the wacky ads. Well, come the early 1970s. Now, remember what I said about highbrow humor and the whole idea of lampooning something, and it all starts with this bubbling under of the baby boom generation of questioning everything. Well, let's fast forward to 1973. All right, you've had the Vietnam War. You've had the Pentagon Papers. You've got Watergate unfolding in front of the nation's eyes. So question everything? You better believe it. Take anybody seriously? Pfft, of course not. The establishment? Screw them. I'll go do my thing. So with that kind of national mental attitude, with the baby boom generation that has now matured into young adults, Wacky Packages is just hitting full stride in the mid-70s here. So it comes in 1973, and it's the sticker set that we're all familiar with, and it has an extremely successful run through 1977. Different series were made, 16 in total, and eventually there were, I think, around 30 cards per series, along with puzzle cards, checklist cards as well. And while they did rehash some of the popular and non-litigated brands from the original Wacky Pack run and the Wacky Ad run, there was a whole new series of advertisements that were created, or items that were created, starting in Series 3. Now, with the pack that I had, and this was actually from one of the kind of rehashed reprint cards that were run in the late 1970s. I've got some great ones here, and I'll just run through some of them. Sudsy Ale, the alcoholic detergent, of course, playing off of the All detergent. And I would imagine that if you were a recovering alcoholic, the last thing you wanted to see was somebody mocking your affliction here. You also had, and this I thought was a great tip of the cap to the people at Mad Magazine, there is a Wacky Pack, number 145 of the 1980 set here, that is of Mud Magazine, humor magazine for pigs. What me wallow is the tagline on there. You also have Hollowhead Milk Muds, a playoff of Milk Duds. It says makes milk taste just like mud. Yummy. And if you flip it over on the back, I've got a Series 3 checklist from 1980 here. So you also have, let me just read some of these other ones here. Checklets, of course, playing off the bubblegum Chiclets, and Checklets is spelled like Czechoslovakia. Let's see, what else we have here? Raggedy Ant, Heavy Trash Bags, National Geographink, Brandyland, Shorts Illustrated, Copperbone, of course, the Coppertone suntan lotion. Let's see what else. Pepto-Dismal, Cheap Stick, which is supposed to be Chapstick, I would imagine. So you can imagine how some of these brand names may not have as much of a sense of humor about these products as Topps did. A few others from the pack that I had: Balding Brand Football, playoff of Spalding. Sufferin coffee, which I believe is, I totally drew a blank. I drew a blank while I was opening this. Sanka. That's what I think it is. I think it's Sanka brand. I may be wrong. There may be some brand from the 1960s or 70s I'm unaware of. But same old grind causes classroom suffering. Coffee for school teachers. That's great. As a child of a school teacher, I know totally about what's going on there. And last but not least, Screech Tragic Embalming Tape, a take on the Scotch brand of Scotch tape. And, basically this was kind of this ghoulish, a mummy chasing a screaming young lady here on the cover of the Screech Tragic Embalming Tape. And I mentioned this in the video link that the video that we posted. If you type in Wax Ecstatic, Wacky Packages, and Garbage Pail Kids into YouTube, you'll find it. We posted it yesterday. But this, I think, is also a nice little tip of the cap to a lot of those late night or weekend local television station, local hosted horror movies. And in Tampa, we used to have one here called Dr. Paul Bearer, and he passed away years ago, decades ago, actually. And he would be on what was then an independent station, Channel 44, and it was on every Saturday afternoon, I think at 12, and it was called The Creature Feature. And in between the segments of some horrible B-movie that he would show, he would come up with these, again, fake little lampoon products that he would sell. So something like Screech Embalming Tape would be it. And you see something similar to this if you live in the Chicago area or if you have MeTV as part of your cable system, or if you have HDTV, it's often an HD channel for a local TV station. Svengoolie. The son of Svengoolie, I should say, the original Svengoolie came around in the 70s, but son of Svengoolie, Rich Cause, who's been doing it for about 40 years now, he does this too. Every now and then you've got these little mock products that they goof off with, and they're very typical, terrible jokes, worse than dad jokes, dead jokes, I guess you can call them. But, I think this is a nice little tip of the cap because, Screech Tragic Embalming Tape is something I could totally see Paul Bearer doing in Tampa, or Shock Armstrong before him, or Svengoolie or son of Svengoolie doing stuff like this. So I thought that was kind of neat. Now, as I mentioned, these particular cards I got from 1980, these were reissued in 1979 and 1980. There were four rerun series with 66 cards in each series, and were for the most part the same as what you saw in the original run in the 1970s. Now, Wacky Packages have come and gone in numerous forms and fashions. They popped up again a couple times in the 1980s, came back in a flashback series in 2008, and then started getting the Topps Chrome treatment just a few years ago. And there was also an officially licensed crossover with Major League Baseball. Yes, believe it or not, the fun, free people at Major League Baseball determined that it would actually be kind of fun to have an association with Topps Wacky Packages. So going back, I believe it was 2016 or 2017, you had the Major League Wacky Packages that came out, where basically they took team names or sometimes players and would do a little bit of a lampooning on, if it's not a fan thing that people did, then just the player or the team name or a player name. So for an example, the Arizona Diamondbacks, there was a Diamondback Scratcher, and there's a guy scratching his back with a Diamondback Snake. So again, just kind of these goofy little jokes here, but it was fun to see the Major League Baseball and the Wacky Packages crossing paths. Now, if you recall, one of the names that I mentioned that got behind the beginning of the Wacky Packages was Art Spiegelman. Spiegelman would be a major reason why we have Garbage Pail Kids. And this is the one that I remember the most because I was in the third grade when Garbage Pail Kids came out. It was during the 85-86 school year. And this was what started as a small project, again, kind of in the in the mantra of wacky packages, making fun of a brand name, turned into a monster. And it was very unpopular for teachers and parents for many, many years. And it all started with a play on the Cabbage Patch Kids. Now, if you recall, Cabbage Patch Kids, I believe it was 1983, 84, that was the hot Christmas item. Yes, before PlayStations and Xboxes and Tickle Me Elmos and all that stuff, people were getting run over at the local shopping mall when Cabbage Patch Kids would be put on the shelves. People would just run over, they'd grab them, they were gone. It was nearly impossible to get Cabbage Patch Kids. This was basically one of the dark sides of what became Black Friday in the history of, you know, pre-Christmas shopping sales. And of course, times have changed. Like now, if you're looking for a Cabbage Patch Kid, you can just go online anywhere. You don't have to trample somebody or get trampled trying to get your hands on one at your local Sears. So, you know, back in the 80s, this was such a big thing. And the Cabbage Patch Kid, of course, all these years later, is still very well remembered and high regarded as an example of a hot holiday season toy. And a lot of, especially girls, still remember their first Cabbage Patch Kid and, you know, how they, you know, opened up the package on Christmas morning and found it and they kept it forever. So, looking to have a little fun with the Cabbage Patch Kid craze, Spiegelman comes up with the idea of the Garbage Pail Kid. And basically, it was taking the Cabbage Patch Kid or something that looked like it, and much like wacky packages, having a play on the name of the kid or putting it in a very odd or, quite honestly, freakish situation in some cases, and just having some fun with it. Well, obviously, the Cabbage Patch people were not all that thrilled when the cards first came out. So remember what I said about cease and desist. Yeah, it certainly came as the Coleco company, which owned the Cabbage Patch Kid, intellectual property, if you will, sued Topps for trademark infringement. So Topps has this out-of-court settlement where they basically agreed to alter the appearance of the Garbage Pail Kid. So it's going to look a little less than or a lot less than what the Cabbage Patch Kids look like. But also, if you look at the text and the word type of the first couple of series of Garbage Pail Kids, it looks an awful lot like Cabbage Patch Kids. So the Topps people said, all right, we're going to change the look of it so that it's not just the kid that looks different, but certainly the logo doesn't look like it's part of the product here. So even though Coleco couldn't stop the production of the cards, they basically got a little bit of a smudge here and there to make it look a little different. And let's be honest, Coleco is going to make money off of this too, or not really make money off of this, but you know, they're able to keep their name and product out there because there's this spoof product. And when people think Garbage Pail Kids, they're going to think a little bit about Cabbage Patch Kids and vice versa. So Garbage Pail Kids come out, and there's a lot of controversy for a number of reasons. One is it's just seen as a distraction in schools. And I can tell you, as a third grader at Sefner Elementary at that time, it could be a distraction because kids would go out and buy packs and packs and packs of these cards. They'd open them up at home, but then they would bring a stack of cards with them to school. And when the teacher wasn't looking, kids would trade cards back and forth. Or when they were supposed to be playing outside during recess, they would be trading these cards or showing them off. So, you know, a lot of trouble came from this, not just in the kids bringing cards to show off, but also kids bringing packs of cards to sell. Yes, there was always a black market. If it wasn't Garbage Pail Kids in elementary school, it was Airheads and other popular candy in middle school. I remember taking part in that. So there was some controversy there. But then, of course, you have the people who had no sense of humor or who just didn't really want to take the Garbage Pail Kids as anything more than a lampooning. And those were, of course, the always concerned parents. Well, what about the children? And you also had teachers who were not too happy about some of the particular cards that came out. And case in point, as I was looking through some of the cards here, let me see, here we go. From the fourth series, Bruce Moose. If you turn the card over, there is this faux wanted poster, wanted for counterintelligence, substitute teacher. And it has this picture of this goofy substitute teacher with an I am stupid piece of paper taped to his back. But it also, and I just noticed this, it also, if you look close enough, it says fill in name of substitute teacher. So you could think of a substitute teacher you really didn't like, or maybe your regular teacher, write his or her name in there, and you made him look bad with this wanted poster, which you could, it's not an actual poster, it's a card, but you could pin it on a bulletin board somewhere or trade it around with your friends, and they didn't like that. Now, teachers, educators, and parents alike also didn't like the subject matter of some things. For example, one of the cards that we pulled here, Horny Hal. Now, while Horny Hal is stretching his mouth to look like a saxophone, and he's basically playing this mouth saxophone, of course, the name Horny, well, duh, you can only imagine what that's implying. But also, you can look at how Horny Hal is, his face, his the shape of his mouth and everything. There's a lot of double entendre going on here. So whether it was double entendre, a lot of sexual innuendo, or if it was just gruesome stuff like Shorned Sean basically shaving the side of his head. Dang Len, where you have a baby mobile made out of a baby and its various parts. You know, that's kind of gruesome, right? Or Interstella, an astronaut who is throwing up in space, and because there's a lack of gravity in space, the vomit is flying up at the top of the space capsule. You can imagine why a lot of parents and educators were not too thrilled about these particular cards going around. Now, much like every other hot property, eventually Garbage Pail Kids, the popularity waned. First of all, the cards themselves eventually died down. In fact, by 1988, they really weren't a thing. But they did spin off a cartoon as well as a full-length movie, and again, many, many, many sets of cards that were released over the years. Now, the Garbage Pail Kids would come back in the early 2000s, and there were also, much like the Wacky Packages, there was a flashback release back in 2010. And by just a few years ago, along with the Wacky Packages Redux, the new Garbage Pail Kids got the full Topps baseball card treatment. You've got chrome cards, you've got magnet cards, you also have classic sticker style cards, but most of these are basically full-size baseball cards, and that was about it. So what's also interesting about the Garbage Pail Kids, and what really gave it a boost back in 2016, was not only just a full-on blitz of promotional effort by Topps, but also there were Garbage Pail Kids that followed along the 2016 presidential election. So you had Hillary Clinton, and you had the, 16 candidates that were running on the Republican ticket. And as it winnowed down, then you had several Hillary Clinton cards and several Donald Trump cards. And whether you agree or disagree that Topps should get into the politics of this, remember the irreverency that started the whole Wacky Packages and Garbage Pail Kid thing anyways. So it's controversial, and you know, if you like one candidate but not the other, you're going to be pissed off that there's a card either for the other candidate or making fun of your preferred candidate. And to no one's surprise, there is a 2020 version of the campaign trail Garbage Pail Kids coming to you. Now, last but not least, or I should say least, the trash can trolls. And again, thanks to Brian for sending these. These were a very short-lived, in fact, only a one-series product here that tried to play on the popularity of trolls and kind of the Garbage Pail Kid phenomena from the 1980s. This came out in 1992. And that's one big reason why I don't think this worked. It's because by 1992, collecting cards was almost exclusively sports. Yes, there were non-sports cards that were out there, but you were more than likely going to be collecting baseball and football and hockey and basketball and racing and all that than anything non-sports. So the trash can trolls were already, you know, going up against some pretty stiff competition from other collectible items. Also, trolls, which are now very popular thanks to the Trolls movie from a few years ago and the subsequent sequel that will be coming out in a few months, which my four-year-old daughter is lovingly looking forward to. Can't wait to take her to that. But Trolls, which have been around since the 1960s and were just kind of this kitschy little, you know, knick-knack kind of thing that you may collect, they had a little bit of a resurgence in popularity. You may recall in the late 80s and early 90s, you probably had a Trolls pencil or a Trolls pencil topper. But other than those pencil toppers, that was pretty much all there was. You know, there wasn't like this big marketing push for Trolls like you see now, thanks again to the movie. But you know, back then it was pencil toppers and little, you know, bric-a-brac kind of things, and basically just little troll things that brought back trolls for the hippies from the 60s. You know, it was a nice little throwback item for them. So, you know, trolls, even though you saw it in schools and you saw people collect them a little bit here and there, they weren't quite the big thing. And again, you know, there's kind of a cultural change going on in the early 1990s too. Grunge movement going on in music. You've got gangster rap as well. There's this whole new current of energy from Generation X coming up here. And with all this stuff happening, like, who wants a troll card or a troll in general? Like, I remember trolls just kind of falling out of popularity. So there were a lot of things working against Topps with the trash can trolls. And then when you look at the cards themselves, like the ones that we have, basically taking these troll dolls and trying to put them into Garbage Pail Kid situations just didn't work out real well. So you have Phil DeGrave and Unkempt Carla and Pyrotechnic, you know, nothing really spectacular here. And then you have the controversial artwork and storylines behind some of these. Weepin' Willow, it's a troll that's a tree, but a big pit bull's peeing all over it. You know, you can understand why some people would be a little sensitive to that. Or you have Hannah Banana, which is this troll in a jungle that kind of pulling its hair down, and it's showing its brain looks like basically a top half of banana. And it also looks kind of phallic too. So you've got people looking at these going, well, I don't want my kids to have these. So you didn't have a very receptive audience in terms of the young people that Topps was aiming for here. Much like Garbage Pail Kids, adults didn't really care much for them either. And they just never really caught on. They are kind of neat, but I can tell you, even though my four-year-old daughter loves Trolls and the upcoming Trolls movie, I would never show her these cards because she would be absolutely terrified that somebody could do something like this to her beloved trolls, including some of the fake advertisements on the back of these cards, like visit Dr. Pound's Plastic Surgery World or save on Greenberg's Trollit Paper Dispenser. So basically you could use the brains of a troll as toilet paper. It was kind of gruesome. Yeah. So there's our look back at some of the legendary non-sports cards, and it really, again, goes back more than a century ago, where non-sports content, if you will, had to be front and center because sports athletes were not regarded, for the most part, unless you were Joe Louis, you were not regarded in a high light in many cases. And a big effect on society, not only affecting society, but a society effect that created this. So the question everything highbrow humor of the 1950s and 60s creates the wacky packages. It gets strengthened by the very sarcastic, deep discuss of anything, you know, authoritarian in the early 1970s. You had a new era of lampooning in the 1980s, lampooning the garbage or the Cabbage Patch Kids with Garbage Pail Kids. And even though trash can trolls didn't make it in the early 1990s, still you had throughout the late 80s, 1990s, and the 2000s, everyone was still reaching back occasionally to a Garbage Pail Kid or a wacky package. And I don't think it is a coincidence that they've come back with a fever in the last several years, as we now have another generation of people questioning authority and not, you know, looking at any, you know, source of past information as serious or to be taken seriously. And you have a lot of people questioning the legitimacy of a lot of things. And, you know, what better way to kind of poke fun at the legitimacy of people or groups or items, inanimate objects, legendary brand names, than by spoofing them. And that's why I think Garbage Pail Kids have made a successful comeback. Wacky Packages have made a successful comeback. And I also think that they're going to be pretty popular for at least a few more years, because I think as long as this nation in particular continues to be sarcastic and question everything that's going on, what better way to have fun with that sarcasm and spoofing than, you know, making fun of these not so fun situations or making fun of a legendary brand name from corporate America. So it's kind of neat to see how things have come full circle here, especially over the last 30 to 40 years with Wacky Packages and Garbage Pail Kids. And it'll be interesting to see how much farther they go. I do think eventually the cycle ends. I do think that the popularity in those items eventually peels back as time goes on. But I do think that they're here at least for a few more years. And even if they do go away for a little bit, I'm curious how they come back once again, probably 10 or 15 years from now, because retro is all the rage. So what's popular now, you know, is going to come back with a vengeance in 15 or 20 years. So that was our fun look at Garbage Pail Kids, Wacky Packages, and even Trash Can Trolls. And it was a lot of fun opening up these packs here and reminiscing about, you know, letters going home from the principal about how your kids can't bring these cards to school. Yeah, we still did. We still shared them. We still traded them. Those of us who were young entrepreneurs actually sold them. I didn't have many in my household. My parents were a little too conservative, but they did allow us to buy them every now and then. And we could open up a few of these packs. And even though some of these cards were pretty controversial and maybe we didn't get the jokes because we were too young and naive or just dumb, you know, mom and dad allowed us to buy a few of them. And we did have them in our possession for a while. But much like every other collectible you have as a young child, they kind of got lost in the shuffle. I'm sure we sold them all at a garage sale for 25 cents. Probably 500 Garbage Pail Kids cards probably just went out the door for 25 cents. Much like all the G.I. Joe toys that we had too. They just went in plastic bags. We sold them for a dollar and cleaned out our garage. What can I say? Well, what I can say is thank you for your time and tuning in. Again, thank you for the donations that have come at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Keep an eye out on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gumstains as we will post how and when you can place bids on these extra Trash Can Trolls and Garbage Pail Kids packs. We're not looking for a ton of money. I mean, we're probably just going to get like 10 or 12 bucks total for this three pack. But whatever we do get, highest bidder that we get from this money will go right back into the show, and we'll continue to buy some great products to share with you. And again, the excess product that we have will go to Commons for Kids. So as we get back into sports cards here, we will send those extras to those kids' way, and I'm sure that they will enjoy all those cards that we send them, thanks to you and your donations. And again, thanks to your donations, we have the topic of our next show lined up here. We will open up a pack of 1974 Topps baseball. We will talk about the variations of wrappers that causes a lot of confusion. And we'll talk about the confusion of the 1974 Topps set. It's one of my favorite stories of baseball cards. Of course, the Washington National League cards with the San Diego Padres destined to leave for Washington, D.C., but it wasn't to be. And we'll address that, and really a great set. And plus, we'll learn a little more about some of the players inside that pack. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you in just a couple of weeks.